on his hand, and they found the bed, lying down side by side, rolling together, holding on to each other, kissing like teenagers, their hands roving over each other's bodies. Lola sighed. Tom moaned. Lips were moving. He kissed her shoulders, her breasts, her belly. She stroked his butt, his thighs, and she managed to get rid of those boxers. Then he was on top, spreading her legs with a knee, moving closer and closer. He pushed forward and smiled against her lips. "I could embarrass myself here," he said. "I'm wound a little tight." She shook her head. "Let's not worry about making it perfect, okay? We've had to wait so long." "I know people who waited longer," he said. "But we're 40, she reminded him, "and we're getting older by the minute." "You're right," he whispered. Then he found his way home. "Good God, it feels like you were made for me." She just hummed and covered his face with kisses. Tom moved. They rocked. The bed squeaked. They clung to each other, and it happened so fast. Both of them, bursting, gasping, then falling slowly and softly back to earth. He could not take his lips from hers. He didn't even consider rolling away. He held his weight off her by bracing on his elbows. "You have the softest lips in all creation," he whispered against her mouth. "You have the sweetest body, the most beautiful dark lashes." "How do you do it?" she asked him. "How do you always make me feel so beautiful?" "You are," he whispered. "You are the most beautiful woman I know. And I love you." He kissed her again. "I hope it was all right, because I'm in heaven." She laughed softly. "It was all right. Wonderful, in fact." "God, that was perfect." He moved a little. "I'm not leaving."
"That's okay.
I'm feeling very safe right now. Safe and satisfied." "That's so good to hear." "That lock really turned you on," she said. "It wasn't the lock," he said, snuggling closer. "Please don't let me fall asleep."
"Tom, we should talk about something."
"What?"
he asked, lifting his head from her shoulder. "The lock? It's probably a good idea. A better idea is telling the kids we're more than friends. They're old enough that they deserve to know."
"I don't know. You have boys. I still have a young girl. Brenda is 16.
"It's no different with boys," she said. "The kids all have to know the facts of life, the dangers and responsibilities, the joys. We've both been left by our spouses and have made good families while unmarried, but we're entitled to be happy too."
"Do you worry that your kids still hope you'll reconcile with Becky? Because my boys don't want that for me, for us. They've probably already guessed that we love each other."
He smiled and moved a little. He moved a little more.
"You can't be ready again," she said. "That's inhuman." "It's just what you do to me." She put her arms around his neck. "Fine. We'll talk when we have our clothes on." "Probably a good idea," he said.
Dakota went to Rob's bar for dinner on a Thursday night. It had become his habit for several weeks now, and it had not gone unnoticed. When Sid saw him, she just shook her head slightly and gave him a half smile. She slapped a napkin down on the bar in front of him.
"Back again, I see," she said. "Great seeing you too, Sid," he said, treating her to his sparkling grin. "How've you been?"
"Excellent. The usual."
"Beer. Then I'll consider dinner."
"And if Alyssa shows up, you'll bolt?"
"I'm afraid I've been a big disappointment to Alyssa," he said. "She wants a boyfriend, and I'm not him."
She put his beer in front of him. "Alyssa seems to be more tenacious than I gave her credit for."
"Then I'll be an even bigger disappointment, because I'm tenacious too."
I'm getting that. So what's on your agenda for this weekend? He asked. I'm pretty good at relaxing, she said. I have a couple of things scheduled. Nothing terribly exciting.
I'm off on Sunday, he said. Saturday night, too. What's it gonna take to get on your schedule?
We've been over that.
I could get a background check, he suggested with a grin.
Just give up, Dakota, she said. And then he noticed a little movement beside him. Isn't this a nice surprise? A woman's voice said. And just as quickly, Sid was moving down the bar, asking people if they needed anything. Neely. He hadn't seen her in weeks.
Hi, he said. How are things?
Excellent. And you?
Good,
he said, lifting his beer. I'm Neely, she reminded him.
That's right,
he said, as if he'd forgotten.
Dakota.
Oh, I remember. She snapped her fingers, bringing Sid back. He frowned at that action. Can I get a chicken Caesar and a club soda with lime? Absolutely, Sid said. Dakota?
Nothing for me, he said.
So you've been in Timberlake for over a month now, Neely said. Does that mean this little town appeals to you?
It's a nice little town.
And have you settled in for a long stay? She asked, just as Sid put down her drink. Dakota didn't really feel like discussing his plans with her, but on the off chance that Sid might overhear, he told the truth.
I have a job here and I've rented a place, but long means different things to different people.
So tell me what you've seen and done since we last saw each other, she said, sipping her drink.
Nothing very interesting, he said.
He told her about the job, secretly hoping to put her off with his career as a garbage collector. Then she told him she'd gone to a concert in Denver and she'd been shopping for things for her townhouse. Area rugs, throw pillows, art. She suggested she'd have to show him sometime. Dakota frowned. She would just invite him over? She didn't know him. They had no people in common as far as he knew. All she knew was his first name and that he was a trash collector. That kind of rush to intimacy always made him suspicious. She talked on, asking very few questions of him and those few he answered with one word, if he could. He was thinking he would have to skip dinner tonight if she was going to hang around. But when she finished her salad, she put her money on the bar. Well, I'm off, she said. I hope we run into each other again soon.
He was so grateful to see her go that he said, I'm sure we will.
And when she cleared the door, he sighed. How does it feel to be a chick magnet? Sid asked with laughter in her voice.
Do not make fun of me, he said. There's something about her that's a little scary.
She seems perfectly nice, Sid said. Are you ready for your dinner now?
Almost,
he said. He picked up a menu and opened it.
Give me a couple of minutes. I think I might have to try something different tonight.
I thought you were close to doing that, but she gave up, Sid said, walking away with a laugh. Dakota looked through the menu while Sid waited on other patrons and mixed drinks for the waitstaff to take to tables. She paused for a moment to laugh with young Trace, the 17-year-old busboy. Dakota was thinking about wings and potato skins when Neely appeared out of nowhere. He jumped in surprise. I'm so sorry to bother you, she said. I have a flat. I could call AAA, but I thought maybe you wouldn't mind helping me out. I could make it up to you one of these days by buying dinner or even cooking for us. He thought about telling her to call AAA, but he couldn't. He'd always considered it a point of honor to be kind and helpful to women. He said,
No problem.
Then he called out to Sid.
Hey, Sid, I'll be right back. I'm gonna help with a car problem. Reserve my spot, please.
Sure thing, she said. He held the door for Neely. He tried to walk behind her, but she looped her arm through his. It's down this way, she said as she let him pass the diner and around back. The BMW is mine, she said. Her flashy little BMW sat in the dark alley, just two spaces away from his Jeep SUV. He wondered immediately if that could possibly be a coincidence. He bent at the waist, looking at the tires.
"Which one?" he asked, straightening.
Neely pressed herself up against him, and her lips were on his so fast he didn't see her coming. Dakota had had many interesting experiences with women, but this kind of aggression was a first. He gripped her upper arms and tried to move her away from him, but it was hard. She was determined. Finally, he managed to get some space between them.
"What the... flat tire?"
She smiled and shrugged. "I thought maybe we'd get to know each other a little, away from the nosy barmaid." He wasn't sure what made him more angry, being tricked into leaving the bar for a potential tryst, or Sid being referred to as a nosy barmaid.
"Don't ever do this again. It's a bad idea."
"Little uptight, aren't you, Dakota?" she said, rubbing a hand over his chest. He stepped back, out of her reach. He was seething inside, but he kept his cool.
"Here's a lesson in manners. If you want to get to know someone, you ask them. If they say no, you move on. You never trick them. This is creepy. Now go home."
"Come on. You're a big boy."
"Good night," he said, taking long strides away from her.
He walked around the diner and back to the bar. He tried to shake off the weirdness of what had just happened. He got back on his favorite bar stool and saw that Sid had put a glass of ice water there. Grateful, he took a drink. And left lipstick on the glass.
"Shit,"
he muttered, grabbing a napkin and wiping off the rim of the glass and his mouth. She'd nailed him good. "Beer?" Sid asked, slapping down a fresh napkin in front of him.
"Oh yeah,"
he said.
"And the Juicy Lucy with onion rings instead of fries."
She looked at his face and pointed to her upper lip. "Missed a little here," she said.
"I did not kiss her,"
he said, maybe a little too loudly. "You were attacked by a runaway lipstick tube?"
"You have it almost right," he said.
"I thought you were going to try something different tonight."
"Changed my mind. I like what I eat here. I look forward to it. I enjoy it."
"Don't get all goosey. I'll take care of it." He wiped off his lips again. He sighed. No wonder he wanted to get to know Sid better and not Neely. He liked Sid. She was remarkably sane. She was so obviously smart. Her instincts were sharp. He thought she was pretty. She made him laugh, and she challenged him by playing hard to get. Except he knew she wasn't playing. She was hard to get. His hamburger arrived, and he realized he was sulking as he ate. Every time he came to this bar when Sid was working, he was hopeful she'd warm up to him. And every time Alyssa or Neely showed up, things got strange. So, Sid had been through something painful and was playing it cool. Well, so was he. He wasn't looking for a lot, just a nice woman to spend time with, not some crazy broad who was always on the attack.
"You okay?" Sid said to him.
"No."
"Look, she's just a girl trying to make a date with a guy, and..."
"There was no flat tire," he said. "She lured me away from my beer and my meal to get me alone in the dark and threw herself on me. I had to peel her off me. It was terrible. I know guys who would have jumped at the opportunity, but there's something seriously off about her. If a man had done that to a woman, he'd be arrested. I don't know how to make it any more clear. I'm not interested in getting to know Neely any better, or Alyssa for that matter. Both of them creep me out and put me in a bad mood."
Sid stared at him, transfixed for a moment.
"Whew," she finally said. "It was awful," he said, picking up an onion ring. "I'd never do that to a person. There's this thing called manners and personal space, you know?"
"I know," she said.
"Sorry,"
he said, chewing on an onion ring.
"I got pissed off."
"I understand completely." She picked up his beer and dumped it. "That got a little warm while you were breathing fire," she said,
getting him a new frosty mug and fresh beer.
Here you go.
Thanks, he said.
He nursed it slowly, done flirting for the night. In fact, he might be done for all time. He was a little surprised by the turn of events. He'd been on the receiving end of some blatant come-ons in his day, but he could usually discourage the idea without anyone being hurt or becoming angry. He finished his beer and stood to get his wallet. Sid was in front of him with his check.
Two beers and a burger, she said in her usual business-like tone. And here is where I'll be on Saturday night if you still feel like coffee, she said, handing him a second slip of paper. There was an address on it. He raised his eyes to hers.
You'll be perfectly safe. Besides, that shade of red does nothing for my coloring.
Then she grinned.
I don't want your pity, he said.
But he said it with humor in his tone.
Good.
7 o'clock.
He walked to his car, thinking that, yes, she felt sorry for him. He was clearly insulted and angry about being played as he was. But that was okay. Even though it hadn't been a strategy of his, he was willing to take advantage of the situation. And over coffee, he would charm her and make her laugh. It was with this very hopeful and encouraged feeling that his SUV came into view. All four tires were flat. He looked around to see if anyone was there. Neely's car was gone, and the small parking lot behind the diner was quiet. He looked at the other cars. Tires all fine. Then he went back to the sidewalk, where it was well lit. He pulled out his phone and called Cal.
Hey,
Cal said.
Hey, I've never done this before, called my big brother when something happened. What happened? I'm in town. I was having a burger at the bar and grill, Rob's place, 2 doors down from the diner. A woman asked me to help her with a flat tire, and when I went with her, there was no flat, just a very eager woman. So I extricated myself, but it was awkward. I must have offended her. Now I find my tires are all flat. He took a breath. I guess I have to find a tow truck.
Sheesh, Cal said, sounding more alert.
You know this woman? Just her first name. I thought she was a nice woman, but her come-on could use a little polish. You think she did it?
Cal asked.
Doesn't that seem a little extreme? You have to call the police before you call the tow truck, and I'll come and pick you up. I can handle this myself. You want the next guy who's not interested in her to get 4 flat tires? We don't know for sure that she did it, Dakota said. Sounds like we do. We just can't prove who did it. Call the police, tell them what happened, ask them what towing service they recommend. Ugh,
Dakota groaned.
This is Timberlake, Cody, Cal said. We don't experience a lot of that sort of thing. If you don't say anything, another guy could be vandalized. Or maybe she'll try something bigger on you. I think I'd rather just handle this. Now you sound like a woman, Cal said. I want you to think about that. I'll be there in 20 minutes.
The notion that women don't report crimes because they're afraid or they just want to forget it happened and hope it won't happen ever again had briefly crossed his mind, but he'd pushed it away. There was also a certain amount of humiliation involved in being victimized. Victimized and then tattling. He wouldn't have called Cal if he hadn't been looking for someone to cut through his bullshit. Of course it was Neely. Of course she shouldn't be pulling that shit. Then his mind wandered further. He didn't want Sid to know. He didn't want to seem less than strong. The way a woman didn't want her boyfriend or husband to know she'd been assaulted because she wouldn't want him to think she was dirty, or think she'd brought it on herself. Cal arrived before the deputy.
Show me the damage, he said.
Once he checked out the car, he said,
That took a lot of effort. Look out for this one. She's mean.
To Dakota's relief, only one tire on his SUV was slashed. The rest were merely deflated. Odd that he should have had that in common with Neely. Deflating tires to prove a point. And it gave him no peace of mind to know she was traveling around with some dangerous sharp object. He thought about the incident a great deal more than he wanted to. The vandalism would probably just be a misdemeanor. He tried to imagine her in her fancy clothes and boots, crouching in the dark, manipulating the air out of the tires. His insurance company covered the tow, but he had to get Cal to drive him to work early in the morning. He was pretty angry about the whole thing. But by Saturday, he was looking forward to seeing Sid. After work, he plugged the address Sid had given him into his GPS. He focused not on his unpleasant experience with Neely, but rather on going to some coffee shop in Colorado Springs where he would concentrate on demonstrating how desirable he was. He would find out more about Sidney, entertainer with stories of his world travels, and, if necessary, exploit his actions as a soldier and hero. He never did that first. He always saved that as a last resort. He looked around, but couldn't find the address she'd given him. The directions were clear, but he had trouble believing they were correct. He hadn't been to Colorado Springs before, but he had trouble envisioning Sid inviting him to a trashy side of town.
"Please, God, don't let Sid be a whack job. One is enough," he thought to himself.
He drove around the block, but no coffee shop turned up. There wasn't even a Denny's or a truck stop. He finally bit the bullet and took the slip of paper she'd given him, and after locking his car, went into the only place on the block that appeared to be open. It was pretty run down, had a big cross on the door, and the sign, which could not be seen in the dark, said, "Free Dinner." He thought it might be a storefront church of some kind, and they would at least know the neighborhood. He walked inside and discovered it was a soup kitchen. He had to weave his way through people standing in some kind of line to find whoever was in charge to get better directions. Then he saw her. Sid was standing behind a serving counter, smiling like she'd never been happier. She wore a green apron, a scarf covering her hair, and rubber gloves, and wielded a big spoon. He chuckled and shook his head. He cut the line to walk up to her.
"Coffee?"
he said, giving her his best smile. "Glad you made it," she said. "Clay, give this man an apron and show him what to do." A man travels the world over in search of what he needs and returns home to find it. George Moore. Chapter 5. Dakota felt as though he'd been tricked again, but this time in a good way. It took him about 5 minutes to get into the idea of serving free food. The clientele was as varied as the human race. There were a few grizzled old men, or maybe they were only grizzled and not so much old as worn down. A pair of elderly women came in together and passed through the line with their trays. He served a family of six, the oldest child no more than 10. There were several families, not always with both parents. A young man was there with his toddler son, who sat on his lap the whole time. He spotted a young couple, maybe 20 years old, followed by a few kids being led by what could only have been a big sister. A couple of boys around 12 came in with no adult. Then a vet, wearing a purple heart on his denim vest. To him, Dakota said,
"Greetings, brother. Thank you for your service."
More old men and women arrived, and he wondered which were street people and which were merely poor. A few people came in over the course of a couple of hours who Dakota realized were not in reality, and he thought this was what his father would have become without the anchor of his wife and family. While a few looked as though they could benefit from some drug or another, there were also those who appeared to have benefited too much. They were of every race and ethnic group. Black, white, Hispanic, Middle Eastern, even a man with a strong Australian accent who said,
"Thank you, mate."
They had only one obvious thing in common. They were hungry. Once the food had all been served, the next step was the inevitable cleanup. That was when Dakota became acquainted with some of the volunteers. Sid introduced him to a 68-year-old woman in jeans and a flannel shirt. "Dakota, meet Sister Mary Jacob," she said.
"You're a nun?"
he stupidly asked. Nuns used to be much easier to identify.
You were expecting Mother Teresa? She asked. I might not look like you think I should, but I'm a damn good nun.
Dakota met a retired man who called himself a professional volunteer and gave his time to many organizations, from the Anti-Defamation League to animal rights causes. There was an elementary school teacher and her husband who liked to help out at least twice a month. He learned that a retirement community sponsored the soup kitchen, as well as an at-risk school, and there was always someone from their group there. And there was a youth minister from a local Methodist church.
Sometimes I bring a few kids with me, when their social calendars allow, he said.
This particular soup kitchen was run and managed by Sister Mary Jacob. She knew just about everyone who came for meals, and she knew every resource in the area, from rehab to where to get clothes and haircuts for job interviews. He was just about finished mopping the floor when Sid handed him a cup of coffee.
Thanks, he said. Is this my coffee date? Because I was really hoping for a little pie to go with this, like from a coffee shop or a diner, or maybe we could go batshit crazy and hit a Denny's.
She laughed. We could do that. Let's head back toward Timberlake and go to the Denny's on the highway. He followed her all the way to the restaurant, a little afraid she might ditch him on the long drive. But she waited by the door while he parked. They had no trouble getting a table, late as it was. They sat across from each other in a booth, ordered coffee, and Dakota asked for a moment to look at the menu. But he didn't. Instead, he looked at Sid and asked,
"Soup kitchen?"
I guess you don't meet too many of your potential girlfriends at a soup kitchen? He lifted his eyebrows.
You've upgraded your status, he said. I thought I was going to have to work much harder for that.
I feel sorry for you, she said with a smile.
Whatever ticks your clock. Just explain the soup kitchen. Is it some kind of test to see if I'm charitable?
It actually has nothing to do with you. After my divorce, I needed counseling. I struggled with depression. I think that's not unusual or unexpected. After some months of talking about myself and my feelings, the counselor gently suggested I might want to take the focus off myself and see what I could do for the less fortunate. She gave me an intimidating list of places that needed help. I just couldn't bring myself to cuddle terminally ill toddlers, and if I'd worked at an animal shelter, I would have brought them all home. I went to the soup kitchen, and Sister Mary Jacob tried to feed me. She couldn't wrap her head around me as a server. That's how bad I must have looked.
Must have been worse than just a bad divorce, he said.
She paused for a moment, as if considering how much personal information she'd give him on this, their first date. It made him smile for two reasons. One, it wasn't much of a date. And two, she was very protective of her privacy. When she continued, he decided she must have at least branded him as a good guy. Actually, I've heard about worse. It was very sudden, and I never saw it coming. It turned out I didn't have good coping skills. My brother and I have suffered some losses, significant losses. Our parents. First my mom when I was just little, then our dad later. Rob was married by the time we lost our dad, and I was in school and pretty much on my own. I was focused on school. Then Rob's wife passed away. She was 29. They had two little kids, sudden onset heart disease, an infection. She was on a transplant list, but she shrugged helplessly. It all sounds so horribly pathetic, doesn't it?
Sounds horrible, yeah, he said.
I don't know what Rob has told people, but I don't like to go through that whole sad story, so I've only told a few people. Mary Jacob is relentless. She wormed it out of me. I have a couple of friends from the bar, but if you wouldn't mind...
I don't have that many people to talk to, he said.
Just on the off chance you decide to talk to Alyssa or Neely?
I don't think so, Sid, he said.
Can we talk about you now? She asked.
As soon as we order cake.
I thought you wanted pie. He flipped open the dessert menu and showed her a picture of a 3-layer slice of chocolate cake served with ice cream and whipped cream. "That looks evil," she said, "and perfect." When the waitress came back to refill their coffee, he asked for the cake, 2 pieces. "Are you afraid to let me dip my fork into your cake?" she asked.
"Absolutely not," he said. "I'm just afraid you'll dip it too much."
Then he grinned. "You had your teeth whitened, didn't you?" she asked.
"No, I brush and floss."
"Okay, what's your story?"
"I'm not that interesting."
"I'll be the judge," she said. It was his turn to pause, trying to decide how honest he wanted to be. The whole story might be overwhelming, but he could give it a start. She'd trusted him. He could return the favor.
"As you know, I grew up with Cal. I grew up with California, Sedona, and Sierra. Our parents considered themselves hippies. But we grew up humbly on a small farm in Iowa, and there wasn't much to spare, so each one of us had a plan to break out of that poor existence. My plan was the military, and I enlisted the second I was out of high school. I liked the military. I liked the standardized routine. It worked for me, and I gave it my full attention. But eventually, I burned out, just like I should have known I would. So I discharged, but without a plan. I went to Australia to visit friends and see the country, then came here because I am now an uncle. Because Sierra and Cal are both here. God knows I didn't want to settle in a small Iowa town, and my plan was just to visit and get my head together. But this place, this is a real good-looking place.
And your parents?
Getting old and still back on the farm. They don't farm it, however. They lease the land.
How many times has your heart been broken? Sid asked.
How far back should we go?
He asked.
Pam Bishop ripped my heart out when I was 14. I'm not sure I'm over it yet. There were others, but then I broke a few hearts too. I never meant to.
The cake arrived and Dakota picked up his fork.
Things don't always work out the way we want them to.
No, she said, and she lifted her fork.
You're beautiful, he said. I'm sure you've left several broken hearts in your past, and you probably disappointed more than a few eager young studs.
If I did, I was unaware of it. She took a big bite of cake with a dollop of ice cream. I never dated much.
How is that possible?
You're flattering me, that's all. I was shy, I guess.
You've definitely overcome that, he said.
He ate some more chocolate cake.
You're a smart-mouthed wise-ass.
Well, I work in a bar. We're supposed to act like we're having fun. Most of the time, I am. Plus, I have overcome a lot of my shyness. It was necessary that I either get over it or spend the rest of my life in a dark closet. With the door closed. He shook his head.
It's hard to imagine you as shy. Nobody gets the best of you.
Not even you, Mr. Jones, she said, licking her fork.
See?
He said with a laugh.
See? You're a hard case. So tell me, how often do we go to the soup kitchen?
You don't have to go back to the soup kitchen, Dakota. I'll have coffee with you again, even if you don't.
I want to. I like it. I've done similar things, usually as part of the job, rescuing and helping the disenfranchised. That's something the military is pretty famous for. We might be in pursuit of the enemy, but the war-torn civilian communities need our help. Fills the well,
he added, scooping more cake into his mouth.
Now, wasn't this a good idea?
I love cake and ice cream. Did Rob tell you? He shook his head.
I have no insider knowledge. I'm just very intuitive.
I don't want a boyfriend, Dakota, she said.
I don't really want a girlfriend either, but sometimes I just can't help myself. So, the soup kitchen. How often?
For the next month, I'm on the schedule 3 Saturday nights. I'm taking 1 Saturday night off. I have plans. He did not ask what kind of plans.
They keep a schedule?
Mary Jacob needs to know how many bodies she has for serving and cleaning up. If she runs short at the last minute, she has to call emergency volunteers.
Maybe I'll just go every Saturday night, he said. Tell me about some of those people, he said.
The volunteers?
Yeah, sure. And what do you know about the people who come to eat?
Oh, they're all so different and interesting, she said, lighting up a little. There were more than a few kids who lived on the street, some elderly people whose Social Security wouldn't cover their expenses, a family who'd enjoyed prosperity when both parents had been employed, but then their company downsized, leaving them unemployed. There were a few vets who weren't adjusting to civilian life, some PTSD going on there. And she went on. She talked about how Sister Mary Jacob tried to funnel these people in the best direction to get all the help they needed, from counseling to government assistance. Dakota asked a lot of questions, and they finished another cup of coffee while Sid ran the tines of her fork over the plate to mop up every bit of chocolate.
If you lick the plate, I won't be embarrassed, he said.
She laughed at herself and pushed the plate aside. After he paid the check, he walked her to her car.
I'll follow you until I make my turnoff, he said.
Okay, I'll go slowly for you so you can keep up, she said. He laughed, and then she stood still and looked up at him. So, if you don't mind me asking, just how did you get over all those broken hearts? He was quiet a moment. It was dark in the parking lot. He looked down at her pretty upturned face and sighed.
Who says I got over them?
He said softly.
Maybe there were one or two that made me cry like a girl every night for a year.
A very small smile curved her lips. Well, hell's bells, Dakota. I believe that was not a bullshit answer. She gave his cheek a pat. Thank you for that.
Don't let this get around, but some of my family calls me Cody.
That made her smile broadly. See you around, Cody. Dakota had not lied to Sid. He just managed to tidy and abbreviate his autobiography. He might as well have said, I had my ups and downs. He might be coming to terms with the truth for a long time to come. He'd found his teenage years torturous and humiliating, and the pain of those years was still festering somewhere deep inside him. He'd been razzed, pranked, and tricked. Pam Bishop really had hurt him, but it hadn't been as benign as he described. He'd asked her to a school dance, and she'd accepted, but as a joke. And when he went to meet her at the dance, she was with some other guy, a guy who had buddies. They all laughed at him for being stupid enough to think some cool girl might want to be his girlfriend. Dakota had gone alone, not with friends, and he'd left alone, walking home, miles and miles. With hot tears burning his cheeks, he schooled himself on what was and was not cool. There were other tricks and jokes, endless battering he took because everyone knew his father had secret friends, the kind only Jed could see or hear. He found his locker lined with tinfoil, the kind Jed sometimes wore on his head to keep the government from reading his mind. He felt like his throat ached in want of tears for 4 straight years. He'd remained mostly friendless and ashamed, and he was so angry. And then he found his escape. In the military, he was able to have his new beginning, spending the power of his anger on his physical performance. He became the Army's shining star, and he was open to a whole new world of friends. He might have been the only soldier he knew with a schizophrenic father, but there were plenty of men and women escaping painful childhoods of poverty, abuse, homelessness, and unhappy and disjointed families. He'd taken comfort in their existence, feeling for once he was not the only one, the only square peg in a round hole. There were women. Finally, there were women. In fact, most of them seemed honored to be noticed by him. He wasn't sure how he'd gone from being the local town fool to the resident McHottie. He kept looking in the mirror and seeing the same long face, large teeth, bushy brows, nose with a bump that he found slightly too big, and yet the girls were suddenly breathless and eager. He even met a few who lasted, who he thought he might one day settle down with, who rode or Skyped with him every day while he was deployed. There were also a few military women he spent time with here and there. It wasn't unusual to have a girl back in the States and a girl on deployment. It was just the way of the world, he thought. Until he fell in love. That brought the whole world into focus for him. Colors became brighter. Music held special meaning. Words of love were not silly, but profound. He'd taken a short gig as a recruiter near a university because it would give him a chance to pick up some credits toward his master's degree without being interrupted by deployment. He heard a speaker at the university who knocked him out. She was lecturing on human rights, and the second he saw her, heard her, he went into a trance. She was stunningly beautiful and brilliant. After the class broke up, he approached her, stupid with lust and cunning, and said, "I'm an Army Ranger, and I've been to most of the places you were talking about. Would you like to get a drink sometime and talk?" She smiled and said, "What about food? Italian?" "That would be perfect," he said. Their connection was instant. Their chemistry was powerful. He was a goner. They even had a great deal in common, given he'd spent a large amount of his time in the Middle East, and that was her humanitarian focus. It was perfect. And, on a university campus, just another romance. To the students and professors, there was nothing unusual about them. He could almost forget that in the world at large, they might be misunderstood. Hasna was a Sunni Muslim. Her parents immigrated from Jordan before she was born. She was finishing her PhD in international human rights, had worked as an interpreter for the UN, and been in the Peace Corps. She wanted to dedicate her life to alleviating human suffering and raising the stature of women wherever she could. She sometimes wore a hijab. When he met her, her head was uncovered, or he wouldn't have offered to buy her a drink. On their first date, she wore her hair free. She rarely wore a black scarf when she covered up, as she favored colors, particularly pastels. She explained to him the way she grew up. Her mother taught her that the hijab symbolized modesty and respect for their religion. Hasna honored the religion of her family even if she didn't practice strictly. She covered her head when she visited her parents, who lived in Los Angeles, when she worked alongside a male colleague who was Muslim, when she went to the mosque. But Hasna had her own interpretation of Islam, much to her parents' dismay. She had obviously pursued her education, worked and earned money, which she kept, and she refused to have an arranged marriage. It set her at odds with her parents for years. Then she introduced them to Dakota. Her parents, remarkably, did not die on the spot, but they were less than thrilled. The passion between them was quick and hot, and Dakota was consumed by it. At first, he had trouble reconciling her Western ways, especially when seeing her wear the hijab. But he soon learned Muslim women were as individual as any others. She was a brilliant feminist, of course. He warned her that her parents would not approve of him. They would naturally prefer she accept a Muslim husband. She laughed wildly at that, asking him where she was supposed to find a Muslim man who would accept her as she was, so independent and demanding. He told her he was in love with her before 2 months had passed. They began to discuss the challenges they'd face as a couple, and how they were willing to find a way to bridge their diverse cultures. "Will your parents accept me?" she asked him. He had laughed before telling her about his father. "He could as easily take you for Abraham Lincoln as a Muslim woman." Her mother could not hide that she liked Dakota, but there was no question her father did not. Nothing mattered. In his 30 years, Dakota had never felt that kind of completeness. After being together just a few months, he would have walked through fire for her. Then there was an attack, an act of terror. She'd been in London at a meeting and had gone to dinner with a few colleagues afterward. Their restaurant had been targeted by a lone wolf terrorist who drove his bomb-laden vehicle over the sidewalk and into the restaurant. 11 people died and many were injured. His beloved Hasna was lost. And so was Dakota. Hasna's mother called to tell him the terrible news, but he'd already heard from one of her colleagues. She was buried by her family in a sacred place, and the prayers were offered in the Islamic tradition. But because Hasna had so many friends and colleagues who were not Muslim, her mother opened her home to them so they could gather and comfort each other. That was the end of everything. There was no ongoing relationship or friendship with her family or her friends. He felt like he lived in a black hole. But he was back in training, then deployed, then sucked back into a world where someone in a chronic angry or dark mood didn't stand out. He was lured back in time to his first experience in the army, when the best thing he could do to leave the past behind was to be the best, to achieve. One day, sometimes 1 hour at a time, he moved on. He'd never talked about it. There was never an opportunity to say, "I was in love with the most incredible woman, and she died a violent death, and I will never be the same." When Sydney got home, the house was quiet except for the rhythmic purr of her brother's snore. He sat on the end of the sofa, feet up on the ottoman, book in his lap. She smiled to herself. If she'd been paying closer attention, she would bet he hadn't read an entire chapter in a month. But he was diligent. He kept trying. He probably got home from the bar at about 11, took off his shoes, propped up his feet, and read. He worked such long days. He never lasted long. She touched Rob's knee, and his eyes popped open. He stared at her for a second. Then he grunted and sat up straighter.
"Time's it?"
he asked. "Almost 12. She sat down in the chair at the end of the sofa, kicked her shoes off, and put her feet up. They each had their own ottoman, like an old married couple. "Are you home early or late?"
"I came home at dinner time for about a half hour. Got the boys fed and went back to work. They went to a ball game with the Rogers boys. I knocked off at 11 to be here when they get home. Mitch is closing the bar. Trace is cleaning up."
"If you'd told me, I could have arranged to be home for them," she said.
"No one really has to be home for them. They know how to unlock a door and lock it up again. But I wanted to hear about the game. And, you know, be here." "Late for you, isn't it? You have a big crowd tonight?"
She shook her head. "Pretty regular. But I tricked Dakota Jones into helping out. Then I had coffee and cake with him." Rob looked startled.
"Is that so?"
"Don't get that look," she said. "It was just coffee. He's been pestering me for a while now. It couldn't hurt." Rob put his feet on the floor.
"Sid, you don't have to be alone forever."
"Neither do you," she said.
"I'm not trying to be,"
he said.
"I've had dates."
"I think you've had hookups, but I make no judgment," she said.
"But dates? I'm low-key about it, that's all. I don't want the boys to get all up in my business about lady friends. It's not like I have a lot of spare time."
"You've had dates? Actual dates?" she asked. "Like, where you go out to do something? Like, dinner or something?" He let his chin drop in a brief nod. "Like who?" she asked. He gave a helpless shrug.
"That woman from the kitchen supply warehouse, Trisha. I took her out 3 or 4 times, but she made it pretty clear she was looking for something with a future. Then there's a friend in Aurora who's the opposite. She doesn't want a serious relationship. That's working out a little better."
"It's been 10 years, he said, speaking of his wife's passing. Sid's mouth stood open. "You never once said..."
"What? That I'm ordering kitchen supplies and going out to dinner? Here's what I say, Sid. I say where I'm headed, approximately when I'll be back, and that I'll have my cell if anyone needs me. If it's you or the boys, I pick up if I can. If it's work, I might call back in 10 minutes. After I listen to the message.
You never said you were going to see a woman.
Was that important? He asked. You've lived here with us for a little over a year. You've come a long way from that dark period. Your divorce has only been final for about a year, and that was a challenge. That bastard was going to wring every last dime out of you. You were adamant that you weren't looking for another relationship, and I don't blame you. After all you went through. Though at the end, you came out of that joke of a marriage with your purse. Thank God for decent judges. But you didn't want to meet men, and you refused those who showed any interest. My situation is completely different, he went on. I have 100 reasons to be discreet. I'm a busy guy and a business owner. I have kids, and I don't particularly want someone else's kids, too. I hate fix-ups, and that's the first thing that happens when you admit you're open to the idea of dating. I avoid complicated women. Should I go on?
All this time, you've had a sex life, she said.
All this time, for the last 6 or 8 years, I've had a private life that sometimes includes sex, and not nearly as often as I'd like. What does this have to do with you? Have you been avoiding the opposite sex for me? He asked.
Of course not, she said. It's just that the first time I accept a date for a cup of coffee, I come clean. All this time, you've been completely normal.
Normal for my situation, maybe. Not optimal, but all right. Tell me about Dakota. Is he a nice guy?
Sure, she said. Yes, you know he is.
He's new around here, but he has good connections. What made you decide to take a chance on him?
It was coffee. I didn't take that much of a chance.
I knew we'd have to have this talk eventually. Sydney, I think it makes sense for you to be cautious and go slowly after what David did to you, but if I believed the majority of men were like him, I'd lose faith in all mankind. Just take your time. But when I think you might close yourself off from life, I could cry.
There's more to life than finding the next man, she said.
Way more, especially in your case, he said. You gave up so much. He cost you so much.
So now I'm finding the balance in life, and apparently you already found it. But hey, the next time you have a date or whatever it is you have, just tell me you're going to the library and I'll be sure to cover for you.
Rob looked amused.
You should go to the library sometime, Sid, and I could cover for you.
I think it's gonna be quite a while before I need you for that. The family is one of nature's masterpieces. George Santayana. Chapter 6. Connie Boyle was on his 24-hour shift, but he took a little personal time to go home. He wanted to talk to Sierra right away. He didn't think he should wait until his shift ended the next morning, although he did suspect it might be better if they slept together after having their talk.
Well, isn't this a nice surprise?
She said when he walked into the house they shared. She'd just been emptying the dishwasher.
Are you home for dinner?
I have a couple of hours, he said, and we have leftover lasagna.
Let me make a salad to go with that and warm it up. She stopped what she was doing and looked at him. Is something wrong?
He sat down across the breakfast bar from her. Molly immediately stuck her cold nose into his hand for a pet.
Yeah, it was a bad day. There was an accident. A fatal accident. But there was a survivor. A 4-month-old baby boy. We don't even know his name.
Oh, Connie, she said.
She walked around the breakfast bar and put her arms around him.
Sometimes I don't know how you do what you do.
Sometimes I don't either.
Is he gonna be okay? The baby?
Looks like it, but he's getting an extra thorough workup.
When did it happen? She asked.
This morning. There were 3 cars out on the highway, but only 1 fatality. Plenty of injuries, though. And 1 car caught on fire. Everyone got out, just some minor burns. But the baby. There was just him and the mother, and She died at the scene.
He shook his head.
They're going to be looking for the family, but in the meantime, he's in emergency foster care. Tonight, Rafe will take him home.
Rafe?
Rafe and Lisa are certified foster parents.
Those two, Sierra said. Aren't they just pure gold? Three kids of their own, living on firemen's wages, and they take in foster kids, too.
Well, it's because they have three of their own that they're only signed on for emergency foster care.